Hello and welcome to Against the Law, the ancient history podcast that aims to separate fact from historical fiction. Today's episode is all about our pesky pet peeve from the ancient world. Since it's a brand new year, we're trying not to let the small things bother us, so we're getting it all out of our system now. You know pet peeves, right? Those irritating things that can really ruin your day, like when you're on the toilet and somebody didn't replace the loo roll, or when you're in the office and somebody inexplicably thinks it's okay to microwave fish in the communal kitchen, or when you wake up before your alarm but it's too early to get up and somehow too late to go back to sleep, or when you're on the train and somebody decides to have a loud conversation on speakerphone so the entire carriage can hear about their Aunt Veronica's bunions and how she's having them filed off next Thursday by a podiatrist she found on Facebook Marketplace, and I'm getting too heated. So, let me introduce my fellow irritated friends. First up, we have Xenia, who has a love-hate relationship with ancient Roman history. I'm also joined by Meg, who is surely ticked off by some ancient Greek nonsense. And Barney's here to share some topics about the ancient Near East that really grinds his gears. I'm Flo, and I don't know much about the ancient world, but I do know all about being annoyed by things. So, let's get disgruntled together, dear listener.
So, who's feeling the most angsty today?
I've had a pretty full-on day. I can go first, if you like.
Yeah, Xenia, unload on us, please. What are your biggest historical pet peeves from the ancient Romans?
All right, well, my really big one is how people talk about Queen Cleopatra. Yes, she's the Queen of Egypt, but she was big in the Roman era. So, I'm going to take her for the Romans, please. And also just do a few against the laws that I hear all the time, but also just generally our approach to her can be incredibly loaded with actual ancient propaganda, which is both annoying and actually really interesting. So, against the laws, yes, she was Queen of Egypt, but she was actually from what is now modern day Greece, although it was called at the time Macedonia, but it wasn't the modern day Republic of Macedonia. So when Cleopatra comes into contact with the Romans, this is like very, very alien for them. They can't really deal with the idea of a woman being powerful. And she was incredibly powerful. Like, we think of the Roman Empire as one of the biggest empires in the ancient world, right? But Egypt, before it became absorbed as part of the Roman Empire, was like insanely wealthy. It had wealth Rome could only dream of. When you hear about Caesar coming to visit Cleopatra, all of the Roman sources obviously big up Caesar, but honestly, he would have been so intimidated by the kind of shows she could put on, by the kind of wealth that she could flaunt. She really had the upper hand in this relationship, pretty much all the way up to the Battle of Actium in 31 BC. And even that victory for the Romans really wasn't clear-cut at all. It was absolutely on a knife edge right up to the end. You know, sometimes when we look back at history in hindsight, we think about it as inevitable. It really wasn't. Like, Egypt could have taken over the world on multiple occasions throughout history. And it's genuinely fluke that it became part of the Roman Empire. Fluke? Or propaganda. Now, this is where I really want to get into the exciting bit. So, Cleopatra and Julius Caesar, he's trying to cozy up to her, as I said, extremely powerful, wealthy ruler. She's having a bit of trouble with this younger brother that she's married to. He's a terrible ruler, and Julius Caesar and some Roman mercenaries help her to get rid of him so that she can be queen by herself. Lovely jubbly, just one ally helping another in the power game of the ancient world. However, they also enter into a relationship and she bears him a son called Caesarion. The assumption here, especially what's come down to us from a primarily Roman perspective, is that the fact that she entered into a relationship with Caesar makes her subject to him. And I really want to emphasize, absolutely not the case. She is worth 10 of him, maybe more, right? He is the one who is trying to win her favor here. It genuinely doesn't matter who she sleeps with at this point. She is queen of one of the wealthiest countries in the world. Then Julius Caesar gets assassinated. What a shame for Cleopatra, because now all of that lovely sort of geopolitical relationship that she's built up has gone wrong. However, they're then in the power play that follows within Rome. Rome splits into two factions, one run by Brutus and Cassius, who are all set on restoring the Republic. Meanwhile, Octavian and Mark Antony are sort of the pro-Caesar faction, and they fight. Octavian and Antony win, but then they start to argue as well. So there seems to be a power struggle for, you know, who's going to become the most powerful politician effectively in Rome. Is it going to be Mark Antony? Is it going to be Octavian, who is the adopted son of Caesar? Like, Mark Antony was Caesar's best friend, Octavian is Caesar's adopted son. So they've sort of both got a claim on the whole Caesar brand. So Mark Antony thinks, what a good idea it would be to go and pursue this alliance that Caesar had built up before. And he goes and has a chat with Cleopatra. She has a ton of money. Now, Mark Antony, by all accounts, was pretty fit. Cleopatra decides that she's going to have a relationship with him as well. Again, absolutely her business, but this is where Octavian and propaganda comes in. Mark Antony looks like he's building for himself like this incredible base. He's got a great alliance. He's got money. He's got resources. He's got armies. Octavian's worried. What on earth can he do here? Well, he can do the usual thing that people do when they're upset with a previous friend or political ally. They can blame it all on a woman. And who's this lovely, convenient, but also Eastern and other woman that he can blame it all on? Ah, look, it's Cleopatra.
I literally thought you were going to say Yoko Ono there. Like, you know, the guy's breaking up. Whose fault is it? The woman's fault.
Exactly. And you see this happen again and again. Why? Because actually some of these assumptions that we've made about women and Orientalism as well, but like we've actually inherited some of those assumptions. So this is why I think it's a huge pet peeve of mine, and I think it's so important to go against the law on this. Octavian publishes pamphlet after pamphlet after pamphlet, really making the most of Cleopatra's otherness, like the fact that she's from Egypt and different, the fact that she has all of these different customs from the Romans. He drags up her past relationships, he drags up her sex life, he publishes all sorts of ridiculous rumours and disinformation about what she gets up to in her spare time, which is, you know, absolutely entirely her business. He makes out that she's drunk all the time. This is, again, a common trope, like women being out of control from drinking too much. All of this sounds horrifically familiar. Why? Because, honestly, Octavian was, you know, some might say the absolute source of this trope. Can I just reel back, actually, to this gold statue of Cleopatra? There's some historical evidence to suggest that Octavian put statues of his own wife and his own sister Octavia next to her, precisely to like set up these rival ideas of womanhood. That was a very, very clear visual distinction of what it means to be Roman versus what it means to be non-Roman, and projected, all of that was projected onto these women. Octavian wins the Battle of Actium against Cleopatra and Antony. And he consequently destroys any kind of counter-propaganda that Antony published. In fact, we've only got one single bust of Antony, and that's from about a century after the Battle of Actium. We have no evidence of him from that period. And not only that, but when Octavian was then setting up the state, the empire with an emperor, he was the first emperor, the Emperor Augustus, when he was kind of defining what that brand would become, he commissioned several different texts, several different poems that actually became school texts afterwards. So people learned Latin, they learned about their own history, they learned about the Roman Empire through this binary of Roman versus non-Roman, of Octavian versus Cleopatra. And all of these poems make her out to be, like, they reinforce this idea of her as drunk, as having sex all the time, as doing, like, weird, to the Romans at least, weird religious rituals. And that's what we carry with us actually right down to today. She knew 9 languages. She was incredibly powerful. She was incredibly wealthy. It was up to her how many children she had and with whom. And yet we continue to judge her by Octavian's frame.
I'm now also as angry as you are about this pet peeve, which borders on absolute abject hatred. I've got to say, you've triggered off quite a few pet peeves from my side. If you're ready for a quick fire, 3 things that you've triggered off of
me. Yeah. Let's go. Let's get it all out.
Right. Number 1, this gold bust of Cleopatra made me think about shiny, gaudy things. And I have been thinking a lot lately about how much I dislike the trend, which has been started by Mrs. Hinch, who is a cleaning expert, to have everything in your home silver or grey satin. Everything is in grayscale and there's no joy. The living room, grey. The dog is now grey. The children, they're all grey. It's depressing. It's like a Werner Herzog interior design move. I hate it.
I agree with that one.
Just all the silver shiny things. I don't like it at all. We're all turning into crows. The second thing that really annoys me is the alliances that you were talking about between, you know, people who have known each other for a while and have done favours for each other, right? Mm-hmm. So I have a particular set of skills that sometimes come in handy when people want something fixed or done quickly or produced or whatever. I hate it when they start a message that's like, oh my God, hi Flo, how are you doing? Haven't spoken in 5 years. Oh my God, what are you up to? Where are you living? What job do you have? What are you up to? And then I'm very suspicious about all this. And then eventually it's like, anyway, listen, I don't know if you could. I would really appreciate if you could just do X, Y, Z. And it's like, I'd be absolutely fine if you just started the message with, can you do this for me? Just ask me for the thing. I'll do the thing. You'll have the thing. And then it's done. And then we can go back to ignoring each other for another 5 years. The other pet peeve I have is about women just existing and then being like blamed for things, like Cleopatra was, or like judged for things that's totally nobody's business. So when I was younger, I thought I was really cool and hip. I've probably shown how uncool I am by using the word hip there, because I thought, Botox, lip fillers, why would you do that? I'm going to age gracefully. I'm not even going to dye my hair when I go grey. But it's none of my goddamn business. If Botox makes you feel a little bit better about wrinkles that you have in the corner of your eyes, do it. Have Botox on every inch of skin that you have. Don't, because it is the most toxic substance known to man. But we don't need a news article saying, oh, do we think that this person has had Botox or lip fillers? It's none of your goddamn business. Stay out of it. Back off. I'm really mad now. My face is actually hot.
Cleopatra's kind of an early example of someone who was in the public eye and people therefore felt they had a right to know things about her.
Well, we don't talk about how Tom Cruise's face is shiny and smooth like an egg despite the fact that he's 108. He can't have had any surgery. He can't have had any lip fillers or Botox.
Is it not the Scientology god Xenu who's keeping Tom Cruise's skin young?
Yeah.
Are you sure that's not an ancient Near East god, Barney?
Are you trying to trigger a pet peeve from me, Flo?
I'm going to try to trigger you now. I want to share the anger.
Actually, that is one that I hadn't anticipated, but it is a fairly decent pet peeve. That, like, whenever there's a demon in a horror movie or something like that, it's always Babylonian or Sumerian. And then despite the fact that it has those names, those ancient Near Eastern Mesopotamian names, they inevitably communicate with them in Latin as well. Mm. 2 birds with 1 stone there.
Yeah, I can understand why that would set you off. But yeah, sorry, Xenia, I didn't mean to slightly jump on the bandwagon of anger, but I had to.
Oh no, please. I mean, that was the point of my whole, yeah, my pet peeve was just how early you see these horrible sexist tropes.
And we're still not over it.
Yeah.
Well, it's just this like need to somehow negate women who have power.
Girl boss.
Gaslight, gatekeep, girl boss.
That's this episode. We are gatekeeping the ancient world and we're girl bossing while doing it.
Is that the new live, laugh, love?
Yeah.
It is. Barney, honourably, you can also girlboss for the
you can girl boss.
Today's episode. You're allowed.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
If you gatekeep, though, then...
No, none of that. I mean, I was thinking about this in terms of pet peeves, because they can be a bit gatekeepy, right? Like, often it's to do with somebody's specialism and it being misunderstood or misinterpreted by non-specialist people. Xenia's there, obviously, is not like that, because that's an extremely developed and still relevant sociocultural point. But like one of the pet peeves that I have, one of the minor ones, is when people used to ask what I studied or what I was doing at university sort of thing, and I said Assyriology, they would often repeat back to me Syriology, assuming it was something about Syria. And I get it, because Assyria is not a common word really for most people. Whereas Syria is, you know, as a modern country, and also for being in the news quite a lot over the last decade. So I kind of get that one. But like, you can see how it can lapse into being a bit of a gatekeeper, because I have this specialist kind of knowledge and the person that you're talking to does not have that. But I hope it doesn't come across that way.
No, not at all. On the flip side, when I told people that I did psychology at university, people would say, oh, does that mean you can read my mind?
I feel like every degree has one of those like little platitudes that people trot out after it.
Yeah.
I also just feel like if you could read people's minds, you wouldn't be doing psychology. That's like, you wouldn't need to. That'd be the opposite, almost.
I just sit in a cafe close to a psychology lecturer and get a free education. As it happens, I'm paying back my student loan even now. So that wasn't the case. I mean, you know, in terms of gatekeeping in the ancient world, I find that you guys are really good at explaining things for me. And I can see just from our discussions about how things can be really annoying. Meg, in our chats, we've talked a little bit about some current news that might be a little bit annoying and gatekeepable.
I mean, I'm not going to lie, guys. December was a difficult month for everybody, but it was a particularly difficult month for ancient Greek speakers. So because everybody has been mispronouncing the word Omicron, and that's how it should be pronounced, Omicron, with a short O at the beginning. Some people are saying it Omicron,
which is particularly annoying because,
as I explained a few weeks ago, in a very bit of timely explanation from me, Omicron was just on the horizon, and I was already spewing straight facts about its ancient Greek origins. Omicron means little O. Omega means big O. So if you pronounce Omicron Omicron, you're using like a totally different letter in that word, if that makes sense. It would be like calling the letter B J, just, you know, like totally mispronouncing the letter that represents the sound, Omicron.
But anyway, that's been one of the things that's been annoying me about Omicron. Obviously not the main thing.
Yeah, I would say that the main annoying thing about Omicron is, you know, the hospitalizations, etc. But, you know, you go off, Meg. You go off about pronunciation. That's fine.
Flo, I thought this was a safe space to rage.
I've got to agree with you about the pronunciation. I think grammatical pet peeves is a really common one. Mm. And for me, grammatically, there are various things that really naff me off. One of them is people saying that they could care less.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I could care less about COVID. Well, do it then, care less. The other one is particularly fitting for our podcast because they're called Janus words.
And a
Janus word is a word that can mean its own opposite. And Janus is obviously the double-headed god, one looking back, one looking forward.
Oh, like inflammable.
Yeah, inflammable, but also things like fast. Fast can be moving very swiftly, but it also could, something can be stuck fast.
Oh my god, I've never noticed that.
And it really annoys me, and it might be because I'm on the autistic spectrum, but words like inflammable really bother me because I want to know if the thing is flammable or if it is not flammable. To dust, I could sprinkle dust on something and that would be a dusting of flour. Or I could dust and remove dust by dusting. But you don't know that. I could say I've dusted the house. You go, great, come home, open the door, and everything's got a fine layer of powder.
You're getting a bit 1984 here. Like, we need one verb for everything.
We need to double plus undust.
I love the idea of you just like massively misunderstanding an instruction to dust the house.
Are they also called auto antonyms?
I don't know. That sounds nice. Right. Antonym and synonym. If I have twins, that's what they're going to be called.
Antonym and Cleopatra.
Oh, we've come full circle. So another pet peeve of mine is when somebody interrupts you just when you get into the flow of telling a story. Like, I remember once I was...
Anyway, I've been trying to get in a little point about Orientalism for a while now. I feel so bad, Flo. In seriousness, I think my pet peeve is quite amorphous, but is generally all lumped around the idea of Orientalism, because obviously studying the ancient Near East makes it subject to those kind of forces. But like a nice little way into it, I think, is, again, when I started off at university, everyone thought I was doing Sanskrit. I don't know why. Nothing to do with what I studied. But a lot of people called it Sanskrit, which I often wondered if there was something slightly orientalizing in that like people assumed that an Eastern language had something to do with the desert and the exotic. But more specifically, and I think we've talked about this before, is the treatment of the East in popular culture and in the West, I mean, throughout the Western canon, as the bad guys. So we've definitely talked about 300 before, in which, you know, the Greeks are all buff and beautiful and the Persians are effeminate, power-hungry, greedy, maniacal, deformed, many, many different things. And that's a prime example of this. And but it, you know, it's a very Western thing. And I think we've talked about before it being sort of derived from the classical tradition, especially in the example of 300 and its adaptation from Greek sources. But yeah, like it's influenced by what we read in the Bible, in which the Assyrians and the Egyptians are antagonists. I'm not saying that's orientalizing specifically. That's just how it's come down to us from our perspective. And yeah, the Persians, obviously, the antagonists in Herodotus, but these are Western sources, obviously. And so having the opportunity to study the indigenous sources from the ancient Near East completely gives a different sense about any sort of opposition that might exist, especially as they were major world empires who were conquering others. So, you know, you think that there's the Assyrians sacking Israel in the Bible, for example, it barely figures in a lot of the Assyrian sources. It's one of those, like, I didn't even know who you are kind of things. They're just one amongst many of people that were conquered by the Assyrians. And so the good and bad narrative that you get is entirely relativistic and fairly unhelpful when thinking about the ancient world, I think.
I was just going to say, with the Bible, it's such an interesting one how that's evolved, because obviously it comes out of exactly the same region. It comes out, you know, Israel, as you've just said, has so much contact with all of the other different empires that constitute what we now call the ancient Near East. And yet we feel like the Bible is much more Western because of how Christianity has evolved since. And I think sometimes to the detriment of our historical understanding.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And I think also this kind of East versus West narrative does have something to do with major world religions as well. And the fact that the ancient Near East has been obscured is partly due to the fact that, you know, that history is not and cannot be embraced by Islam. You know, there's no continuity between the ancient Near East and the Muslim world. And so that means that that history, that lineage is kind of severed. But yes, I think, you know, the best that I've always thought that people can do if they're interested and if they want to learn more about it is to study and learn those historical differences, you know, not in terms of good and bad or even necessarily in terms of East and West, just, you know, immerse yourself in an area and look at it sort of dispassionately and always be aware of modern cultural narratives being imposed over the top. But also, I mean, you know, me extolling the wonders of studying the ancient Near East in and of itself rather than through another lens is great, but that's not to say that Egyptology and ancient Near Eastern studies are exempt from criticism themselves as disciplines, because, you know, they're not. As modern scientific endeavours are essentially colonialist, right, in their origin and up until very recently in modern scholarship as well. Because, you know, they started out with essentially adventurers and amateurs and pre-scientific endeavours, basically, of fairly elite people claiming another part of the world's culture and essentially looting and sending things back for museums in Europe. And that made up the first half of what we know as modern Egyptology and Assyriology. You know, that colonial history to these disciplines kind of still leaves a mark on indigenous scholarship today.
Yeah, absolutely.
I just wanted to point out that there's a pet peeve that other people have that I don't have, based on you talking about Sanskrit. So that, I don't know if it's got a proper word like auto antonym instead of Janus words, but people call it eggcorns instead of acorns. Eggcorn is, you might mishear someone say acorn as eggcorn. And it's really common with certain phrases. So lactose intolerance sometimes becomes lactose intolerant. There's a whole forum online on Reddit called Bone App the Teeth. Mm-hmm. Because somebody posted a picture of their dinner and instead of saying bon appetit, they wrote bone app the teeth.
Is it like for all intensive purposes instead of for all intents and purposes?
Yeah, exactly that. And people find it really annoying. And for some reason, it delights me beyond anything you could possibly imagine. I just think it's great. I love it.
I think the word might be reanalysis. When you hear a word, you analyse it. And the reanalysis comes from the like erroneous imposition of other words on top of what someone else is saying.
Yeah, I don't know why, I just, it really tickles me. Like filet mignon as well, like, is often written as flay minion, which is, you know, arguably something that Gru has pondered over.
Yeah.
On the checklist of an evil overlord.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think a slightly lighter conclusion to my big kind of probably slightly vague rant there. Maybe I'm just a bit hurt that the ancient Near East still remains fairly obscure, especially considering the European and American appetite for all things Roman, Greek, and often Egyptological as well. You know, Egyptology is massively popular. And I've heard a lot of people over the years say that maybe this, you know, there was never an Assyromania or Assyriomania, whereas there was an Egyptomania in the 19th and 20th century. And so, yeah, maybe that's partly to blame. And I guess, Xenia, maybe it links back to what you were saying earlier in that, you know, Egypt was in a sense kind of subsumed into the classical world, despite its size and prowess and riches and power and stuff like that. And maybe Mesopotamia was less so, even though it was part of the Roman Empire. It wasn't such a monolith as Egypt.
Yeah, you're totally right. You've really got me thinking about it, actually, because, you know, what is the rhyme and reason behind why we get so excited about certain cultures and not others, or certain parts of history and not others?
I think it's based on how easy people find it to pronounce names, how easy white people find it to pronounce names.
But again, like, we're so comfortable saying lots of very unusual names. We're also comfortable saying Daenerys Targaryen, and like, what is the logic behind that?
Actually, I mean, like, ease of intelligibility and access to things is definitely a good point, right? Because I was reading that one of the reasons why Egypt ended up being more popular is because it has a massively easily appreciable visual culture in the landscape, right? You can just see pyramids.
There you go. I think you've put your finger on it, Barney. It's about the brand. It's about being able to say, yes, we are linked to these people with red standards and a particular font and eagles on their flags. Or we are linked to, you know, these really cool hieroglyphs and these pyramids. It's about branding.
Can I rattle through some Homer frustrations?
Oh! The number one being that Homer doesn't really exist. Like, Homer's not really a real person. We know nothing about Homer. So one of the really interesting things about studying Homer is this massive Homeric question of, you know, who was Homer? Was there a single person who composed the Iliad and the Odyssey? When did that happen? Where did it happen? Was Homer the person who performed them last, or the person who composed them, or the person who, you know, wrote them down? Could be any of those things, and we just don't know. So that's a pet peeve for me. My second pet peeve, I'm just going to plow straight through, is that everyone thinks that the Odyssey is better now. And I think the Iliad is better. And in the ancient world, the Iliad was more popular. And the Iliad was more popular up until like the 60s. And then suddenly everyone's all about the Odyssey. And, girl boss moment, multiple people, this is a true story, multiple people have said to me, why are you studying receptions of the Iliad? Because the Odyssey is so much more like feminine and interesting if you're a woman, because there's more female characters in it. And I just resent the implication that as a woman, I can't love men stabbing each other, you know?
Yes.
I also like when men stab each other.
Yeah, I love it. It's great. I love the goriness of the Iliad. I love how everyone's, it's just all about all these men having these really intense emotions and crying and stabbing each other. I think it's fantastic.
Is it also acceptable for me to be, you know, horny on main for Achilles and Patroclus in the Iliad
absolutely.
And not be in it for the stabbing?
Sorry. Not for the podcast, but what the f*** is horny on main?
Like, horny on your main account.
Oh, I thought you meant like on Main Street, like just like waltzing down with a boner, just like, yeah, that's right, horny on Main.
That is a horrible image.
That's why I was so shooketh.
There are some vase paintings of like satyrs with their massive boners. I think they're pretty horny on Main. I don't think we should keep this in. Yeah. Anyway. Yeah, we can absolutely be into it for Achilles and Patroclus. And I think that's the other thing that I don't like, is the implication that kind of anyone, not just women, should be more interested in a story because it's got more like traditional expressions of deep emotions. And what we now see, you know, is literally called the Odyssey. That's just Odysseus's name. But we now use that as a word that means a journey. And I think a lot of people think that that makes it more interesting because it's a kind of, there's maybe a bit more character development. There's a lot more physical relocation, a lot more actually happens. But I love the kind of intensity and the claustrophobia of the Iliad and how it's all just, oh, being angry and sad in your tent. I love it. I've been on a lot of camping trips and it's...
So normally we, at the end of a podcast, will do our favourite thing that we've learnt that day, but I'm going to now try and go for our least favourite thing. What's the least favourite thing that we've learnt today? Xenia?
I think my least favourite thing was Barney's point about like how the East is viewed as other and more difficult to access. And I think that links in quite nicely with these kind of Roman assumptions that we have about the East that actually contributed, I'm sorry, Barney, to that view.
You're not personally responsible.
So, Barney...
Yeah, so my least favourite thing, and this is definitely testament to the strength at which Xenia sold it, and maybe this is a bit greedy because it was a major diatribe, and I'm sure other people also found it to be one of their least favourite things. But the fact that there's so much complexity and unique history involved in the person of Cleopatra as an incredibly powerful female ruler in a time and place where that wasn't necessarily the easiest thing to be, and the fact that she has just ended up as Cleopatra sexy is very annoying.
And Meg, what's your least favourite thing?
I mean, yeah, it's like, it's a real compliment to say I've hated everything I heard today, but I think it has to also be Cleopatra. Xenia just really sold the hatred.
One of my pet peeves outside of the podcast is when someone finds something really funny and then doesn't tell you what it is. So my pet peeve from today's episode, my least favourite thing, is really, really, really funny. But it doesn't matter. Send me a DM, I'll tell you.
The gatekeeping is getting out of control.
So yeah, that was today's pet peeve episode. I hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.